Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week, and we're very lucky to have him, is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome, Jesse.
How are you, Alan?
So I've been reading you in the Times every day. You're doing terrific work, and I really want to thank you because the state legislature is not well covered. Do you ever think about the Times method? All the guys in the Times come up, do a couple of years here, and then they send them out and they become world famous. But first you have to do your time in Albany. Do you ever think about that?
I think my career is working in reverse. I went out into the world, and now I'm back in Albany, making myself locally famous. Hopefully, how about that?
Well, you know, they used to put a lot of people up here because they all thought the Times thought Mario might be president, so they put people with him here. You think Andrew Cuomo can be president?
Well, that's a question for larger brains than my own. I do think, however, that there are active conversations on numerous levels, both inside and outside of his camp, as to whether or not that is a feasibility. You know, here's a guy who has, since he got reelected in 2014, has been slowly but steadily kind of banking to the left. It's a guy who has proved an adept fundraiser. He's a guy who has been, particularly in recent months, giving the kind of speeches where the word national seems to appear a lot more often than the word Albany does. So you see a politician who seems cognizant, at the very least, of the possibility that he could potentially land on the national stage. Now, whether or not that is his merely wanting to be a national player and, you know, play with the big boys in California and Texas and Florida and places like that, or if he actually wants to run for the highest office in the land, we don't know yet. But he certainly wants a bigger profile, and I think that's undeniable.
Well, you're the guest, but I can tell you, after all my years with Mario on our radio shows and all the rest, I can tell you Andrew wants to be president. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. And part of this is this very interesting, unique psychological profile of a guy who both loved his father, but in some ways is competing with him. Do you ever see any evidence of that?
Well, I think that is as old as Shakespeare and even farther back. I mean, that dynamic of trying to one-up your old man, I think, is something common to men everywhere, and women as well. I mean, the thing that I think is going on inside of Cuomo's brain, if it is not a one-upping of Mario Cuomo, it is certainly a perfecting of what Andrew says that Mario was about, which is progressivism with a practical element to it. You know, you hear this in his speeches again and again, that Andrew views himself as a pragmatic progressive, that he holds, you know, liberal ideals, but that he also holds the levers of power to make those ideals a reality. And so in his speeches, in his private interviews, he repeats again and again his accomplishments, you know, the $15 minimum wage, with an asterisk, of course, but a $15 wage in most parts of the state, the paid family leave program, the fight to get same-sex marriage legalized here in the state of New York. These are, you know, legitimate progressive accomplishments. What goes by the wayside, of course, is the sometimes, you know, Machiavellian ways in which he has gotten some of those things done, you know, by ratcheting support from labor, by pushing legislators into compromises, by the kind of hardball politics that he practices very, very, very well. So, I think that's where he is trying to one-up his father, you know, in actually walking away with kind of solid accomplishments that he can point to, whereas Mario may have been more of a thinker, you know, and more of an idealist, where his son seems to be more of a kind of get things done kind of guy.
Right. Well, you had a fascinating article which laid some light to this, in which you were talking about Andrew and labor. Can you give us a little bit of a reprise of that?
Well, you know, keep in mind that the premise of the article, which was written by with Vivian Wang, who is our great young Capital correspondent that works with me in Albany, You know, the premise of the article was basically that you had seen in 2010 when Andrew Cuomo was running for governor that he was talking tough on unions, you know, that unions needed to be reined in, that they were costing the state too much money, that they were facing, the state was facing this yawning budget deficit, that you had to be tough on unions, that, you know, governors were too beholden to labor interests. And then flash forward to 2018, when he's getting a pretty vigorous challenge on the left from Cynthia Nixon, when you have a kind of a groundswell of progressive activism and energy that seems to be buoying her campaign. And all of a sudden, Andrew Cuomo is the world's greatest supporter of labor, that, you know, gone is the talk of, you know, really, really fighting the unions, and he has fully embraced them. And by the same token, the unions have had the governor's back as well. You know, they had done a lot of squabbling in the press with Cynthia Nixon. They've done a lot of endorsing of either the governor himself or the governor's priorities. And they are promising to bring out the numbers, you know, the get out the vote people and the kind of nuts and bolts political operation that he wants to see in order to bat back Cynthia Nixon's candidacy.
Let me go inside that for a minute. I know that the New York State Teachers Union was furious at him at the time because he was talking about easier to fire teachers, easier to discipline teachers, and all of that stuff. Now, clearly, the labor leaders have made their deal with Cuomo, and they are supporting him, the teachers and others. But I keep meeting teachers who will never forget it, individual teachers on the street who will never forget where he was in the beginning. And they think he's a pragmatist, all right, but of the worst kind of pragmatism, born of necessity as opposed to conviction.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you read carefully in the article that Vivian and I wrote a couple of days ago, one of the interviews we had was with Michael Mulgrew, who heads the teachers union in New York City, which, of course, is where the votes are, right? That's sure. Where you got to win New York City if you want to be governor. And if you read carefully in that article, one of the things that Mulgrew said was, yes, absolutely, we've been encouraged by what the governor has been up to. But yeah, we still have some members who are upset. And I think if you read between the lines there, it speaks to exactly what you're saying, which is for rank and file members of these unions, whatever the leaders might be saying, however the leaders might be endorsing the governor, that's all well and good. But there's still some antipathy inside of those unions themselves at the base level, at the member level, where they don't forget, where they are still angry, where they are still upset with the governor. And I think if you're running the governor's campaign or you're running the governor's administration, that's worrisome, right? Because, sure. You know, as we saw in 2016, with the presidential election, there is a big difference between labor leaders saying we are behind, in this case, Hillary Clinton, and Hillary's our person and she's going to be president, and the rank and file members of those unions saying, not so fast. I don't think I want to vote for that person. So that's where you start to, if you're inside the Cuomo camp, that is a source of concern when you start to hear rumblings that maybe the rank and file are not going to follow what their leaders say.
Flash. Sean Patrick Maloney jumps into New York State Attorney General's race. So what we are seeing here is that unexpectedly Schneiderman, gets caught up in Me Too, and he's gone. And a whole lot of people want to. The establishment has picked a candidate. Who's that, Jesse?
Well, that's Tish James, who is the New York City comptroller, who kind of fairly quickly consolidated most of the institutional support politically in the state around her candidacy. Governor Cuomo came out and endorsed her. Once again, a number of unions came out and endorsed her. And I think, you know, from the outside looking in, it would have seemed to be a fait accompli that she would kind of cruise to a relatively smooth victory in September and then on to a general election victory in November. But as you put it, Alan, I mean, there are some developments here. I mean, Sean Patrick Maloney getting in the race and getting in the race with $3.6 million in the bank, that's significant. Leisha Eve, who is an accomplished attorney and Cuomo and Clinton administration official from Western New York, has also shown no signs of backing down. And Zephyr Teachout, who gave Andrew Cuomo a run for his money with no money in 2014, is also running for attorney general. So this is a pretty crowded field. It's an interesting field in that there's a lot of different types of candidates there that might appeal to different demographics and different people's kinds of interests in politics, you know. So there's not a clear cut, you know, there's certainly a clear cut establishment candidate at this point in Tish James, but there's also a lot of options, you know, for voters who are looking at these elections for the first time. And, you know, as you put it, you know, a month ago or 6 weeks ago, no one anticipated that this race would even be competitive, that Eric Schneiderman would kind of cruise to another term. But now, of course, it seems like all bets are off.
Well, Tish James, Jesse McKinley, Tish James is a little disturbing to me personally anyway, because for only one reason, and that is her career was pushed by the Working Families Party. And when the Working Families Party wanted to nominate her, they said, no, the governor doesn't want me to take that because he's mad at them for not having nominated him and having thrown their support to Nixon. So that means you would have an attorney general who is beholden to a governor. Wouldn't that make people suspicious?
Well, I think that the governor's involvement in the attorney general's race and its vacancy has raised some eyebrows, I might put it politely, amongst good government groups who feel that there should be, you know, at the very least, a separation of church and state between the law enforcement branch of the government and the executive branch of the government, although technically the attorney general does work for the executive branch. And you brought up the issue of Tish James rejecting the Working Families nomination. And that, I think, was illustrative of exactly how much Andrew Cuomo dominates state politics and oftentimes gets his way vis-a-vis the kind of, you know, inside baseball machinations of it. You know, he was rejected by the Working Families Party. They went for his opponent, Cynthia Nixon, big time. They have campaigned for her. They have acted as a surrogate for her. They are one of her biggest supporters and have really kind of bet the farm on her, you know, winning the primary in September. And Cuomo has returned fire. And one of the ways he's returned fire is, you know, basically asking Tish James not to take that line. And that was a real body blow for the WFP, who was, you know, instrumental in getting her first elected. So you can already see the kind of intensity of this race, that it's not just Cuomo versus Nixon, but that it's starting to drag in other members of the political establishment on both sides to kind of, you know, pick and choose which side are you on.
Now, there is, Jesse McKinley, an elephant in the room, and the elephant is known as Preet Bharara. There are those people who think if Preet Bharara goes around, gets signatures, he'd win a primary. Now, somebody wrote me a letter and said since he hadn't registered to vote, he's ineligible to run. Do you know anything about all of that?
That's not my understanding. Nick Reisman.
Mine neither.
Yeah, Nick Reisman, who's one of the great state house reporters that I work with, had dug up the fact that Preet was not registered in the state of New York, that he'd actually been purged from the voter rolls, I think, about a decade ago. But my understanding from Nick's reporting is that that does not necessarily make him ineligible. But that being said, I don't necessarily see that happening. I think for political aficionados like myself and yourself, it's kind of a very intriguing possibility that Preet would get into this race. I mean, he is by far the most famous of the bunch of candidates who have declared thus far. He's got a national profile. He's battled Trump. He would be the darling of progressive voters who want to see someone in that position to kind of continue battles against the Trump administration. That being said, since the kind of initial, you know, rumors that were surrounding a possible candidacy, I haven't heard anything in a couple of weeks. And the clock, you know, the clock she ticks. We're about three months from a primary at this point, and then 2 months outside of a general election. So if you're going to get in the race, you got to kind of get in the race here pretty quickly. So
you got to run.
We shall see. Yeah.
Well,
as he would say, stay tuned, I guess, right?
Well, if I was Andrew Cuomo and I thought the Preet Bharara, you know, after all, who is the man who got all of those grafters who were around Cuomo, was going to be the attorney general, I'd worry about it.
Well, I think that a strong attorney general in the state of New York has enormous power. A state attorney general to launch investigations on a wide variety of things. And obviously, when Cuomo was in office as Attorney General, he was unapologetic about investigating things that were going on in the governor's office or in other state agencies. And so if you want to be aggressive in that position, you can be very aggressive. I mean, you've got 700 lawyers, and you've got investigators, and you've got subpoena power. And you cover, you know, the biggest city in the nation with the financial capital. There is a lot of business you can get into. And that, of course, includes some of the political activities in the state, which is a billion-dollar industry and flooded with money. And, you know, you can stick your nose in a lot of different people's business if you're the attorney general.
Now, you mentioned intriguingly before, about Andrew Cuomo's pluses. You know, he's done a lot, minimum wage, the gay issues, but you didn't mention the negatives. I mean, as I just said, he was surrounded by some people who, pay to play and all of the rest of it, and it doesn't seem to have hurt him, unbelievably.
Yeah, I mean, we shall see. I mean, I think the Prococo case, which came to a conclusion in March, which resulted in the conviction of one of his closest friends and perhaps one of his closer, perhaps his top aide, which was Joe Prococo, that would have seemed to have put a little bit of a dent in him. But I would say that the trial that's upcoming, due to start on June 18th, of Elaine Calleros, who was formerly the head of SUNY Poly, could potentially be more politically damaging for the governor, because in that case, you really have a very strong suggestion of pay to play, whereby Todd Howe, who was a longtime Cuomo family aide, basically went around and asked developers to give money to the governor's reelection campaigns, and then kind of said, well, if you do that, I can kind of grease the wheels to make sure you get state contracts. And of course, the governor is not accused of any wrongdoing, has not been said to do anything wrong. But just the appearance of that sort of arrangement, that's not a good look on a sitting governor. And then in terms of other kind of negatives that Cuomo has been battling, I think there is still the kind of lingering impression that he is not a true progressive leader, that he played footsie with the Republicans for 7 years and allowed the IDC to flourish under his administration. And I think those things, for people that are rabidly engaged in this race, people on the left that really want to see change and really want to see people be true to their ideals, I think there's no way to square that circle. I don't think you can be Andrew Cuomo, who works closely with Republicans, and then also be Andrew Cuomo, who is a true progressive leader. I don't think those two looks kind of fit. So on that flank of the party, I think he's going to have a hard time convincing those voters that he's the real deal, that he's a real kind of Bernie-crat progressive.
We could go in a number of different directions, but I want to stay on that for a moment. You raised something, which is this business of the Independent Democratic Conference. Jeff Klein and his troop of people who, have taken Republican largesse and kept them in office. There are those of us, I'm going to be honest, who have always felt Cuomo was responsible in large part for that, and that at very least he could have done what he ended up doing because he had to, which was to say, come back where you belong. I've written it 1,000 times, I've said it 1,000 times, and, he didn't do it until he had to. But now there's Simca Felder, who is out there, and I'm not so sure that Cuomo hasn't been involved in all of that also, because I can't believe he couldn't get Felder, although he says he's tried, to come back and be a regular Democrat and take the Senate back.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if there's a collusion, so to speak, between Cuomo and Felder. I mean, I've spoken to Simca a lot. I talk to Simca on a regular basis, both in the halls of the Capitol and on the phone when various issues come up, because, of course, he is the pivotal vote in the Senate. And my impression of Simca is that he is very much an independent thinker, and that he is very much and unapologetically a guy who wants to bring home things to his district in Brooklyn. And if you can bring home things for his constituents, there's a large Orthodox Jewish community that he represents, if you can bring, things home for that community, that's where he's going to vote. And so far, he feels that the Republicans in the Senate have provided that. Now, that being said, Simcoe also seems to play coy with this question a lot, where he says, well, you know, I have friends in the Democratic Conference. I have people that I respect. I could conceivably go back. Right now, I've given my word to the Republicans, so I'm staying put. But he's definitely left the door open to return to the Democrats. And I think he is probably waiting for the outcome of the November elections, whereby the Democrats hope to kind of capture, you know, 2, 3, 4 seats and kind of make themselves the numeric majority, no matter how you cut it, you know. And I think Cuomo is maybe hoping for that, maybe not hoping for that. But I think Simcoe will go where he feels that his constituents and his district is best represented.
So let me ask you a political science-y kind of question, which you are certainly more than equipped to answer. Let us assume that the Supreme Court of the United States says no to gerrymandering, finally. And New York has to go the way of Pennsylvania, and things get straightened out. Now, we do know that the courts have done the congressional districts, but what if the state legislature has to be done in a more fair fashion? What kind of effect would that have on our politics?
I think conceivably, and once again, this is highly speculative, but I'll go there just for a moment. I think conceivably the Republicans would probably be disadvantaged in a couple of, you know, kind of increasingly suburban districts upstate where, you know, where those districts are pretty badly rigged to kind of guarantee that Republicans at least have a fighting chance and have held some of those seats. So, but I think the more, as I said before, I think the more pressing problem for the Republican majority in the Senate is the November elections, where Democrats feel very, very confident that they're going to pick up seats, that this is a big year for them, considering the opposition to Trump, and also considering just the kind of engagement which seems to be happening. I mean, as much as you and I are deeply involved and deeply interested in state politics, you know, a lot of people in the state can't tell you who their state senator is or their assemblyman or anything like that. State politics tend to fall to the wayside of federal politics and presidential politics, which actually get people's attention. But that being said, I think that, you know, the attention given to the IDC, I think the attention given to Andrew Cuomo, I think the attention given to Simcoe Felder and some of the weird dynamics in the state capitol have heightened people's awareness. And I think when people get engaged in the process, then they want to engage in the process without belaboring it. They want to vote, right?
Sure.
And so if people start to pay attention to the state races and start to get involved in Senate races and assembly races, I think it probably would be good for the Democrats, right? Because it looks to be a big year for that party. And if that happens, then the Republicans are going to have a problem, because an engaged electorate in a state like New York, where, you know, more than two thirds of the voters are, or they have a 2-to-1 advantage in terms of voter registration, the Democrats are going to do well just mathematically if their voters come out and if their voters get engaged. And it feels to me like they are engaged this year.
I only got a minute, but I want to ask you, can Cynthia Nixon or Mark Molinaro beat this governor?
Well, never say never. I think it's way too early to start to speculate. I think that Nixon's made decent progress in the polls. She's still pretty far behind. I think Molinaro is pretty far behind as well, but considered a viable candidate, probably more so than John DeFrancisco would have been.
Absolutely.
That being said, they both have a lot of ground to make up. And, you know, the summer doldrums will hit here pretty quick. People start to go on vacation. And once again, you've got this issue of kind of getting people's attention and getting them engaged. But if I was Andrew Cuomo, I wouldn't be breathing easy just yet. I think there are kind of larger political dynamics at play, as I mentioned before, kind of a progressive swell and a rejection of centrists like himself that would probably put pause in any prediction that he's going to win this easily.
Jesse McKinley, first of all, keep up the good work in the New York Times. We think you're great. We'll certainly be watching what you have to tell us, and I really appreciate your coming on the Capital Connection. Thanks again.
Absolutely, anytime.
The
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. We'll be right back.